This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.
Japan has a new prime minister. He inherits from his predecessor a pandemic and big economic challenges. The country's also having its own reckoning with racism.
In Japan, it's mostly still just fear. There's not much hate when it comes to blackness.
I'm Marco Werman. In Colombia, protests against police brutality turned deadly, and new revelations into the cause of two airline crashes.
I don't think there is anything worse than continuously hearing how preventable the death of your loved one was.
Also today in Barbados, they're letting go of the island's head of state, Queen Elizabeth.
The time has come to fully leave our colonial past behind.
Barbados will be a republic. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It is official. Japan has a new prime minister. After almost 8 years in power, Shinzo Abe is stepping down, citing health reasons. The country's new leader is Abe's longtime disciple.
Yotte, Suga Yoshihide-kun wo motte, tōsensha to kette itashimashita.
His name is Yoshihide Suga, and he was chosen by his party to steer Japan through some rough waters. The COVID-19 pandemic, a sluggish economy, and his predecessor's unfinished mission to restore some of Japan's past glory. The World's Patrick Nguyen helps break down what this means for Japan and the world. Why was Suga chosen to lead the country, Patrick?
Well, he's a very predictable, stable choice. He's 71. He's not too flashy. He's known as a workaholic. And the main takeaway here is he is going to carry on the legacy of Shinzo Abe. He's basically been Abe's right-hand man. And the word that comes to my mind when I think of Suga is loyal. One important thing, Marco, to understand is that Japanese politics is dominated by this elite circle with many politicians coming from influential families. And Suga was not born into that world. His dad was a strawberry farmer. He used to drive a truck at a fish market, and he worked his way into politics slowly, starting off on a city council. And he got this reputation for being competent and loyal to more powerful figures like Abe. And so it's expected that he will loyally carry out the agenda of the party. And that party is the Liberal Democratic Party, which, despite its name, runs conservative, and it's run Japan almost every year since the 1950s. And I spoke to an analyst named Koichi Nakano, who explained what the party's modern agenda is.
It's often quite flexible with the ideology. More recently, under Mr. Abe, it has taken a turn to the right. And actually, even Steve Bannon praised Mr. Abe for being Trump before Trump. Even before President Trump came up with Make America Great Again, Mr. Abe campaigned on the slogan of taking back Japan.
I think we can expect Suga to continue that nationalist streak.
So with this emphasis that Suga's placed on continuity with Abe's leadership, how will that actually play out?
Well, this has been his main message. I am going to carry out the policies of Shinzo Abe and even the cabinet. He's mostly keeping all of Abe's cabinet. And so for Japanese people, they're going to see a lot of the same faces from the Shinzo Abe years, and it's not going to look very different from the past 8 years.
So let's look at foreign policy, for example. Japan's one of America's top allies in the world. How will Suga affect that relationship with the U.S.?
Well, he's definitely expected to keep pushing Abe's foreign policy, which has been really pro-American. The two countries have this mutual distrust of China, and that's bringing them closer together. You know, Marco, a lot of world leaders have at some point been frustrated with President Trump, but not Abe, who's always got along with him really well, especially on the golf course. I asked Professor Nakano if he expects the new prime minister to get along with Trump as well.
America is going through a very turbulent period. And so even if Mr. Suga wants to meet Mr. Trump as soon as possible and to be liked by President Trump, well, maybe he's not going to have time for that.
And what he means there, Marco, is Trump might not have time to think much about Japan, especially going into the election. You know, Japan is this huge economic force in the world, but especially in Asia, and it's really active in diplomacy on the side of the world. But Professor Nakano told me that he thinks this is one of Suga's biggest weaknesses.
Mr. Suga has very little to show in terms of foreign policy expertise or experience or even interest. And so he's a complete novice who's going to try to learn a new trick.
Patrick, can we expect Yoshihide Suga to remain prime minister for long?
That's a really good question. It's hard to say. So far, he's been chosen to lead by his party and not the general public. So the next general election is in about a year in 2021. So he could wait until then, or he could call a snap election and prove that he's got the support of the Japanese public. Or the party could let him stay on for a while, but then replace him, if he ends up not being so hot, with someone younger and more dynamic before the general election. So we'll see if people do embrace him. I mean, he's a pretty serious guy, personality-wise, maybe even a bit stern. He doesn't drink. He's a workaholic. He's not flashy. But, you know, in a pandemic and in a bad economy, maybe the public doesn't want someone who's being bombastic, you know, on Twitter and someone who likes drama. I think the deal with Suga is, like him or not, you know what you're getting.
Well, either way, Yoshihide Suga, the new prime minister, is a new chapter for Japan. The world's Asia correspondent, Patrick Nguyen, thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
The pandemic and the economy are top priorities for Japan's new prime minister, but there's another that's taking root in Japan, racial justice. Japan's also been impacted by the global movement for countries to confront their own histories and their responsibility to change. The world's Bianca Hillier reports.
Jamie Smith remembers the days and weeks after May 25th. She watched online videos of people marching to protest the killing of 46-year-old George Floyd.
It felt, for me, really hopeless.
Hopeless because Smith, a Black American, couldn't join the rallies on U.S. streets. She lives 6,000 miles away in Tokyo, Japan.
I was angry. I was sad. I was upset. And I was also kind of feeling like I live abroad. What can I do?
What she did was start talking with other Black Americans living in Tokyo. They felt the same way she did and wanted to speak up. So after some grassroots organization, Smith found herself on the front line of the city's largest ever march for Black Lives.
No justice, no peace. No justice, no peace.
We got an apartment for 300, and I think someone called and told the police to maybe expect 1,000. Yeah, that was still too low.
3,500 people showed up. Japanese natives, Black foreigners, white foreigners, holding signs with both English and Japanese characters saying discrimination is born from ignorance and Black Lives Matter. But as those rallying cries echoed through the streets and spread via hashtags on social media, a backlash also formed. Critics accused marchers of ignoring coronavirus risks, and comments online argued racism is an American issue, not a Japanese one.
This is something we've heard a lot. Well, this is an American problem. We don't have racism here in Japan. That's not true.
Smith says the racism she's experienced in Japan is less violent than what she's seen in the U.S.
I've had strangers reach out and grab my hair. Strangers yell kusai, like stinky, at me on the street. Also, my first weekend in this area, I got stopped by police because I had a new bike.
That's similar to what author Baye McNeil has faced in Japan.
Doing things like not sitting next to you, or fleas might jump off of you onto them, kind of detour around you.
McNeil, a Black American who's lived in Japan since 2004, says that's different from racism he's seen in the States.
In Japan, it's mostly still just fear. There's not much hate when it comes to Blackness. It's just fear, and fear comes from the ignorance.
McNeil's writing has focused on dismantling that ignorance for years. He's become one of Japan's most prominent voices on black issues, including the use of blackface, which is well documented in Japanese media. In 2009, Japanese actor Koichi Yamadera appeared on a popular variety show to perform Louis Armstrong's classic, What a Wonderful World. Yamadera performed in full blackface, yet received nothing but applause from the totally unperturbed Japanese audience.
What a wonderful world.
The imagery continued into 2017, when a Tokyo production of the musical Memphis featured a cast of almost entirely Japanese performers in blackface. Then, a New Year's Eve episode of a widely viewed TV show featured celebrity comic Hamada wearing a Detroit Lions football jacket, a curly wig, and blackface. He was said to be impersonating Eddie Murphy's character from the 1984 movie Beverly Hills Cop. Baye McNeil criticized this broadcast on Twitter, and while some defended the show, thousands of people supported McNeil's comments. Since then, there hasn't been another display of blackface in mainstream Japanese media, but racist imagery continues to be pervasive. This summer, degrading depictions of black people appeared on Japan's public broadcaster, NHK. The animated segment was reportedly meant to explain to Japanese audiences what was happening in the U.S. regarding the Black Lives Matter movement. But the show was steeped in racist imagery and reduced protesters to demeaning stereotypes, like men with oversized muscles and angry faces, and looters shown in the background. McNeil says the report is the epitome of Japanese ignorance.
What you saw in an NHK segment was the problem here. We are stereotyped, and the people who are stereotyping us are not really aware that they're stereotyping us. So as far as they're concerned, this is what blackness is. This is what black people are. It looks extremely ugly. You know, it looks extremely racist.
NHK later apologized and took the clip offline and invited McNeil into its offices to discuss the offense. Though he felt like the station was listening to him for the wrong reasons.
I think they were listening for damage control. What can we do to make sure that black people don't get angrier at us, which is going to make us look bad in the media?
NHK said in a statement that they, quote, lacked awareness of whether the description in the clip was appropriate and how it might be received in and outside Japan. Ignorance and a lack of education on black issues is a real problem in Japan, says Kaisei Sugaura, a white 25-year-old who grew up in a region near Tokyo. He joined marchers in the city this summer and has been posting about the movement online. But Sugaura says he didn't know anything about anti-black racism until he moved to the U.S. to go to college.
And then while I was there, I heard about Eric Garner.
Eric Garner, the 43-year-old black man who was killed by police on New York's Staten Island in July of 2014. Garner's case has stuck with Sugaura, and since returning home, he's been talking about racial justice with his friends. He says it's easier to talk about this stuff with his Japanese friends who have also lived in the U.S.
I think they think they're more close to it, to the problem. They know what's going on in the U.S. and stuff.
But even his Japanese friends who haven't been in the U.S. are curious about the Black Lives Matter movement. This week, many are paying close attention to Naomi Osaka, the tennis phenom with a Japanese mother and Haitian father who won the U.S. Open on Saturday after making headlines for wearing masks emblazoned with the names of victims of racial violence. In a press conference, Osaka said her goal was simple.
The point is to make people start talking.
That mission is in line with that of Black Lives Matter Tokyo, according to Jamie Smith. She says the organization wants to unite black and Japanese people.
If we can get that kind of across, then Japanese people might be willing to speak up for us more in places where we cannot, because we're all one community.
It's a community she's proud to be a part of, because on the whole, Smith loves living in Japan and is dedicated to helping create lasting change. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Who is at fault for two plane crashes that killed 346 people? A congressional report released today tries to answer that question, and it points fingers at Boeing and the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration. It concludes that Boeing engineers made faulty assumptions and that oversight by the FAA was, quote, grossly insufficient. These series of errors led to two crashes of Boeing 737 MAX jets, one in Indonesia in 2018, and then a second crash last year in Ethiopia. The report from Congress is the latest in a series of investigations. Joseph Curia Waithaka was one of the victims on board Ethiopian Airlines. His daughter, Zipporah Curia, joins us from Hull in the north of England. There have been several reports on the failures of the Boeing 737 MAX, Zipporah, and I can't imagine what it's like to keep hearing these findings that fault Boeing and now this latest report. What has your life been like since last year when you hear a headline like this?
I would say that since last year, I think our lives, like my life, my family's life, has been completely surreal. You just kind of live through this weird now reality of being a normal person, doing normal things, and then you're just thrusted back into your loss and the reality of the nightmare that is the death of your loved one. You know, yesterday, before the report came, I was just out with my friends, you know, go to the cinema, try to cheer yourselves up. Then you start getting calls from press or you start getting calls from your lawyers. There's an update. This is ongoing. And it just feels like you're back to, you know, Sunday, the 10th of March, receiving the news over and over again. I don't think there is anything worse than continuously hearing how preventable the death of your loved one was.
There have been several investigations into this crash specifically and into Boeing, and now the U.S. FAA is implicated. Has there been any findings so far that's brought you a kind of peace or clarity?
Clarity, definitely. But I don't think there are any findings in this process that could ever bring us peace. In fact, they breed quite the opposite, which is just complete perplexing and disturbance. I think the most clarifying moment thus far has been this report, because it just basically solidifies everything that has come up previously. But I think the worst thing was during the hearing in December, hearing that according to a certain risk assessment, you know, there were 15 crashes that were predicted in the lifespan of this aircraft, and that the crash that killed my dad was the first of those 15. You know, I think that for me was the most clarifying and heart-shattering revelation or discovery that has been made throughout this process.
You yourself have pushed for aviation safety. So what do you want to see happen to prevent crashes like the one that took your father's life? What have you asked for?
The main thing has been transparency. Let us know what we're getting on, what the dangers are, and to also make sure that the relationship between regulators and airplane manufacturers are just that, professional relationships between them, because the coziness of Boeing and the FAA, one of the reasons, you know, according to Peter DeFazio's report, is one of the reasons why we've ended up where we've ended up. That's all we require as the public. You know, the same way that car manufacturers have to be forthcoming. We know about airbags. We know what's supposed to be in a car. We know how it's supposed to function. I think that same level of education for the public and transparency should be there when it comes to aviation, especially when it comes to the 737 MAX.
Zipporah, ultimately, what would justice look like for the victims, like your father, of these two disasters?
I'll speak on behalf of my dad and my family on that. And I think for us, it would be ideally for this plane not to fly again. And for us, it would look like people taking accountability, saying, this is what we did wrong. This is how we're going to fix it, just in regards to the plane. And given the information that's come out today, I think some sort of criminal investigations, some convictions, because since March 10th, my dad hasn't seen life. He's not seen his children. He's not gone to work. My dad has not enjoyed his favorite food, had his favorite cup of tea. He wasn't there during Christmas birthdays. But Muhlenberg, David Calhoun, who's the current CEO of Boeing, who was working on the 737 MAX during the time, are enjoying millions worth of bonuses. It's one of those things where you don't necessarily have to go to prison, even though that would be the ideal thing, but at least take accountability and say, this is what we did wrong.
Just one more thing, Zipporah. Can you tell us a bit about your father? Who was he? Just what do you want the world to know about him?
My dad was like the dopest guy on this planet. He was incredibly like passionate. He was funny and he was really quiet, but impactful. You know, like he really was passionate about people. One thing that he continuously did, which was forever ask me for a cup of tea, which was his way of saying, I love you. And I didn't realize it then. It doesn't matter how hot it was, how cold it was, it would be cup of tea. And I think that's the one thing that I miss the most about him, is making him his cup of tea and everything that came with that.
Zipporah Kuria is the daughter of Joseph Kuria Waithaka, one of the victims of the crash of Ethiopian Air's Boeing 737 MAX last year. Zipporah, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
No problem. Thank you so much.
I know several people who did not like their given name, so they changed them. One small town in Quebec that's trying to change its name is finding that's not so easy. The World's Sarah Birnbaum explains.
You might not be shocked to learn that the town of Asbestos is having a hard time luring investors. That's why the mayor, Hugh Grimard, says the town simply must change its name. The mayor told the CBC that potential foreign investors treat folks from Asbestos like they're contagious. He said at one point a delegation from Asbestos went to Ohio to try to drum up business, and the Americans refused to take their business cards. At a town meeting earlier this week, officials presented the residents of Asbestos with four options for a new name. More on that in a bit. But the entire process has been controversial. Controversial because some people are attached to the historic name of the town, and because this whole thing is also caught up in the French-English divide. The English word asbestos doesn't have the negative connotations in French. That's because asbestos is just a place name. And the French word for asbestos, you know, the cancer-causing stuff, is amiante. So some town residents are accusing their government of kowtowing to the English. Still, the town council moved forward with a proposal to change the name. And come late October, the town of Asbestos might be known as Jeffrey. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
From Japan to Ethiopia to Canada, today's show is a perfect example of how the world's stories connect you to the wider world. Continue that connection on social media. Follow us on Twitter, we're at The World, and join the conversation about the stories that keep you thinking. And take a moment to share the stories that stay with you. Again, our Twitter handle is at The World. At 6.6 million, the United States still has the most reported coronavirus cases on Earth. But India is catching up with 5 million and counting.
The cases we see keeps rising for the last 6 months to the extent that I am tired of looking at my own models.
That story is still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. In the past week, more than a dozen people in Colombia have been killed in connection with protests against police brutality. The protests were sparked by the death of Javier Ordóñez, a 46-year-old father. He was seen in a widely shared video in which police are kneeling on his back, repeatedly using their stun guns on him. Ordóñez later died in a Bogota hospital. The World's Latin America correspondent Jorge Valencia has our story.
Most of the people who were killed were shot. Witnesses say some of the victims were taking part in protests against police brutality. Others appear to be onlookers caught in the crossfire. That includes Cristian Hernandez, a 26-year-old who made a living delivering food on his bicycle.
Me quitaron parte de mi vida.
They took part of my life from me, says Cristian's father, José Hernández.
Deja una niña de dos años.
José says his son left behind two daughters of his own. One of them is 2 years old, and the other is 7. Jose was speaking to local radio and was still trying to make sense of the violence. Confrontations between police and protesters erupted in parts of Bogota and the neighboring town of Soacha for 3 nights last week. They followed an incident captured on video with 2 police officers repeatedly tasing a man who later died in custody. In the protests, people threw Molotov cocktails at dozens of police stations. Officers fired their weapons. Uniformed officers drew their pistols and chased after protesters in several videos posted on the internet. In one case, an officer screamed and hurled a rock from the street into a second-story apartment. Many Colombians say last week's chaos in Bogotá is consistent with their national police's routine abuse of power. It's also a symptom of a political rift between the local progressive government of Bogotá and the conservative national government of Colombia.
Pedimos perdón porque esos hechos ocurrieron pese a todos los esfuerzos y a las claras instrucciones impartidas desde la alcaldía mayor.
Bogotá Mayor Claudia López held a televised remembrance on Sunday. She apologized to the relatives of those who were killed, and she apologized to the city in general. She said she had told the local unit of the National Police to not use deadly weapons, but that they didn't follow her orders.
Apreciamos mucho que el gobierno nacional y la policía nacional.
We appreciate that the national government and the national police have apologized to the family of the unarmed man killed by the officers, López said. But that doesn't acknowledge those who were killed in the protests, she said. In response, the police sought to wash their hands.
Ni el general Rodríguez, ni nadie más dio orden de disparar.
Commanding Officer Gustavo Moreno said in a press conference that neither the police general nor anyone else specifically authorized officers to shoot. But, he said, they were under attack and they have the discretion to fire if they determine it's necessary. That speaks to the Colombian police's routine violence against civilians, says Sebastián Lanz from the Bogotá-based NGO Temblores.
Sí, pues en nuestro informe Bolillo, Dios y Patria, que nos muestran que este no es un panorama nuevo, sino que es un panorama...
Lanz says police killing civilians is nothing new. In an upcoming report titled Bataan, God, and Homeland, Lanz says Colombia's police killed 649 people from 2017 to 2019. And he says there were more than 240 reports of officers committing sexual assault during that period. He says police, in their response to the recent protests, were sending a clear message.
Eso claramente nos está enviando un mensaje, y es que el espacio público en la actualidad no le pertenece a la ciudadanía, le pertenece a la policía.
The message, Lanz says, is that public spaces in Colombia no longer belong to citizens, but rather to the police. Authorities say multiple investigations are underway. They're looking at the officers who killed the first unarmed man, the officers who fired at protesters, and the rioters who attacked the police. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia.
American writer Isabel Wilkerson began her latest book, Cast, long before the police killing of George Floyd, and long before many American conservatives took issue with the argument that systemic racism is at the heart of the problem.
In much of the Democratic Party, it's now fashionable to say that America is racist. That is a lie.
That's former UN Ambassador Nikki Haley speaking at the Republican convention in August.
America is not a racist country.
Isabel Wilkerson disagrees. She sees racism permeating American culture, but she does not think racism alone explains the systemic oppression of black people in America. Instead, she sees what she calls a shape-shifting, unspoken, race-based caste pyramid that maintains hierarchy and inequality in America. My colleague Carol Hill spoke with Wilkerson.
Isabel Wilkerson, thanks for joining us. In the past few months, Americans from many different walks of life have started using and understanding the terms structural racism and systemic racism. At the same time, you're arguing that caste, not race, is a more accurate and useful way to explain the oppression of people of color in America. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean that it's clear that we are not dealing with the classical open racism of our forefathers' era, and that the upheavals that we have been witnessing call for a different language that might liberate us from the language that leads to emotions of guilt and shame and blame that can sometimes obstruct the conversations that we're trying to have. And what I've sought to do is to describe the underlying infrastructure that is the basis for much of what we are seeing. It's our inheritance of a 400-year-old hierarchy that I'm calling a caste system that has some reverberations with and shares some points of intersection with other caste systems, most notably in certain specific ways with that in India. I call it in some ways an X-ray of our country, allowing us to be able to see ourselves differently.
But doesn't looking at it through the lens of caste bring us to the same place as looking at it through the lens of race? We essentially have a hierarchy and inequality. How does that help us move forward?
If we are not dealing with the same classical open racism that we might consider of the past, where people would openly describe themselves as racist, they would openly be proud to describe themselves as racist and picketing against people who want to move into what had been formerly all white neighborhoods. There are many documentaries in which people in the 1940s and 50s were open about how they hated people who were African-American. They wanted to block people who were African-American from coming into their neighborhoods. That is not the same kind of open racism that we deal with today. People are loath to see themselves in that way and often actually do not see themselves in that way. They often describe it as we have inherited an old house. And we don't want to think about what we may be in for if we look in the basement after rain. But if we don't look in the basement after rain, we will still have to deal with whatever it is that is there. Recognizing that caste is the bones of what we are dealing with. Race is the tool. It's the signifier. It's the cue. It's the signal of one's place.
I'm speaking with author Isabel Wilkerson. Her new book is called Caste, The Origins of Our Discontents. I want to talk about that further because, say, for the sake of argument, that everybody recognizes the hierarchy of caste, then what? How do you unlearn it? What are the opportunities or ways now that would move us forward?
Well, first is to recognize how is it that we have absorbed the messaging of caste? How is it that we've absorbed the messaging of who is ranked where in a society? What do we expect a person to look like if they are in the corner suite of a corporation? What does a person look like if they're in the mailroom? What does a person look like if they are the janitors? We have all absorbed the messaging through the generations as to where people are presumed to be.
It's interesting because in your book, you look at the caste system of Nazi Germany, and you say that one thing that led you to that was watching the violence that erupted in Charlottesville in August of 2017 and the debate that ensued over the Confederacy, its history, and its symbols. Let's listen back to President Trump's most contentious press conference that week.
What do you think of Thomas Jefferson? You like him?
Okay,
good. Are we going to take down the statue? Because he was a major slave owner. Now, we're going to take down his statue. So you know what? It's fine. You're changing history. You're changing culture. And you had people, and I'm not talking about the neo-Nazis and the white nationalists, because they should be condemned totally. But you had many people in that group other than neo-Nazis and white nationalists, okay?
Now, Nazi symbolism was very prevalent in Charlottesville in those demonstrations in 2017. President Trump there denounces it. But how do you filter those protests, the Nazi symbols, and the heated debate that tells us about the caste system and the importance of symbols and recognizing them?
What we saw in Charlottesville was really a debate in some ways over memory and how we are perceiving what has happened before us. And that is what led me to look into Germany in the first place. And in looking into the history of Germany, I discovered these unsettling connections that I would never have anticipated. One of them is that German eugenicists were in constant dialogue with American eugenicists in the years leading up to the Third Reich, that American eugenicists were writing books that were big sellers in Germany in the years leading up to the Third Reich. Of course, the Nazis needed no one to teach them how to hate, and they did not turn to America for that. But what they did do is that they sent researchers to study the United States to see how the United States had managed to subjugate African Americans through its Jim Crow laws, through its segregation laws, and its anti-miscegenation laws that prohibited marriage across racial lines. And they studied it as they were constructing what would ultimately become the Nuremberg Laws. So there are connections between these hierarchies that the protesters in Charlottesville on some key level recognize themselves in bringing together the symbolism of Nazi Germany and the Confederacy. They themselves could see the connections there.
I want to end this by asking you whether trying to look at American society and persistent inequalities through the lens of caste, is it a way to bring Americans together? Our country is incredibly divided. And as you say, a lot of whites or dominant castes, they bristle and get all upset if they're accused of racism because they genuinely don't feel that they are racist, and the whole conversation goes pear-shaped. So if we're to understand persistent racism through the lens of caste, is that a way to bring people together to talk about this and their own plights?
I think that we need new language to hone in on the structure, the infrastructure that we've inherited, as opposed to the emotions that can arise from language that we often attach to the past. And thinking about the country as an old house, it is not an emotional thing to think about, okay, I've got to do this and I've got to do that with this old house. It's just, it has to be done. And you go in, you roll up your sleeves and you recognize this is a building, this is what needs to be done, and you go in and you get it done. You define the problem, you lay out what is necessary to address the problem, and then together, one would hope we could come together to really deal with this problem and hopefully, beyond all of it, to heal.
Isabel Wilkerson, it's been a real pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The World's Carol Hill speaking with writer Isabel Wilkerson. Wilkerson's latest book is called Caste: The Origins of Our Discontents. 5 million, according to India's health ministry. That's the number of confirmed COVID-19 cases in India. That's since the start of the pandemic. For reference, the U.S. is at about 6.6 million confirmed cases. India has a far bigger population than the U.S., but the numbers in India are rising rapidly. And most experts say that India will likely become the worst hit country in the world within weeks. Let me turn to Brahmar Mukherjee. She's a professor of biostatistics at the University of Michigan, and she's been modeling India's COVID-19 outbreak since March. Professor Mukherjee, India's cases are going up really fast. Can you help us understand these numbers? Is this a new spike?
No, unfortunately, this is not a new spike. India is not at the point where it's having its second wave. It has been holding on to its first wave, unfortunately. And the reason for this is that, you know, India is a very big country, so there are lots and lots of states. So in the first part of the pandemic, certain states came to boil and hit their peak. But then there are other states which are coming. So at the national peak is sort of a confluence of regional peaks. And that's why the cases we see keeps rising for the last 6 months, to the extent that I am tired of looking at my own models.
I mean, despite the alarming number of cases in India and the fast rising ones, most experts are surprised that the death rate there is relatively low. How do you explain that?
Yes, so that is probably the only good news which is working in India's favor. But there is an underreporting factor for deaths as well. Even if we take that into account, normally, even without COVID, only 1 out of 5 deaths in India are medically reported. So with the cause of death for COVID being misclassified or misassigned, then you can anticipate that there is an underreporting factor for deaths as well. Even with that, I feel the infection fatality rate, if you look at the distribution all across the world, India is on the lower side. And that could be a multitude of factors, including cross-immunity, it could be genetics, it could be India's youthful population. But I would like to say that if the country, 50% of the country gets infected the way the cases are going, then even with a 0.1% infection fatality rate, you are going to end up with 670,000 deaths. And so each statistic, each death is the face of a loved one.
Even while cases are rising in India, restrictions are getting kind of stopped. More businesses are reopening. Students are back in class studying. What about the government response from New Delhi? Does it worry you? Are they going in the wrong direction?
So, you know, I have been very disappointed at how things are going. That initial lockdown really helped us to build our healthcare infrastructure, have a testing and contact tracing strategy. But it has been going for so long. So I think it's a habituation, desensitization, fatigue, a fatalism that there is nothing we can do. And also sometimes a sense of denial that this is how it is supposed to be, that we are defenseless against this virus. It's indeed a very difficult situation for India. But I think that the public, the government, and the scientists really needed to work in concert. So I feel that there is a misconception in the mind of the public and the government that the lockdown is a cure-all for this virus. But we never really understood that this is a long haul and social responsibility, collective sacrifice, vigilance, resilience, these lofty words are going to be needed in order to survive this crisis.
So you talked about the government response there. What about the people on the street? Because last week you wrote on Twitter, Brahmar, "I am so disappointed with the pandemic situation in India. It is getting worse and worse each week. But a large part of the nation seems to have made the choice to ignore this crisis." How do you explain that, ignoring a crisis that has affected at least 5 million people?
This is what I see in India, particularly in Delhi. When there is a very large number of rising cases in June, then the government really escalated testing. Everybody was wearing masks. But now, even in social media, the pictures that you see, the mask is really hanging like a neck piece in an ornamental way. And people are relaxing. People are letting their guards down. And the virus, as we all know, is not silent anymore. And then they are coming soaring back up.
Yeah, it sounds similar to the U.S. where people have also let their guard down, not to mention their masks. Brahmar Mukherjee, professor of biostatistics at the University of Michigan. She's been tracking and modeling India's COVID-19 outbreak since March. Thank you very much for being with us again.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to talk to the world.
Back in May, I had told you that it had been 7 months or so since I'd gotten on a plane. Now make that 10 months. And no plans in sight to travel. I know I'm not alone. Revenues for U.S. airlines are down about 80%. That is unprecedented. And that's just one example. Josh Solera, a global industry consultant with the firm Egon Zehnder, spoke with us in May about this and said then that carriers were waiting for the beginning of fall as a deadline for the industry getting back in the black.
If passenger traffic doesn't improve substantially before then, I think October 1 could be a really big reckoning day for the industry.
That was Josh Solera back in May. Josh joins us again for a reality check. Josh, October 1st is now almost here. Is the industry on track to rebound?
Indeed, Marco. Here we are, and unfortunately, it hasn't seen the rebound that I think many observers would have hoped. Without additional support from the government, it is looking like October 1st is going to be a big day for layoffs in the industry.
Where have the big hits really happened?
Where do we start? There was some improvement in leisure traffic kind of midsummer that then fell off as cases spiked back up. So leisure traffic hasn't rebounded as fast as people would have hoped. More importantly, business traffic has continued to remain really far down.
Do you see business travel ever getting back to where things used to be? And what would it take? I mean, aside from a vaccine for that to happen?
Well, ever's a long time, Marco. So I do think it will at some point. But we're talking several years in all likelihood at this point.
What is your sense, Josh, of how airlines have dealt with the risk mitigation that public health officials say is absolutely necessary on an enclosed steel tube with recirculated air? Has the reputational hit across the board been damaging?
Overall, I think the carriers have done a pretty good job. I think the biggest challenge, though, Marco, has been that there hasn't been a standard approach. And so you have some carriers still blocking middle seats. You have other carriers overbooking flights. So the lack of a consistent set of guidelines, I think, has been damaging. But overall, I think the carriers have done a lot very quickly, and they're heading the right direction.
So what you've been describing, Josh, it really is a sea change of why people think it's important to get on a plane. Are we going to end up seeing just a handful of carriers still flying at the end of this?
Well, the airline industry in the States, at least, is very consolidated. You may see some smaller carriers run out of money. I do think, though, at some point, you're not going to Zoom your vacation. And so people are wanting to get back and go see their grandparents, go on the holidays, and time will tell which carriers are able to manage through this crisis better than others. And things are evolving so rapidly, we shall see.
What are you optimistic about right now, Josh?
I'm optimistic that carriers are viewing passengers as customers that need to be won. I think this whole situation is making companies realize that they can't take for granted that people will just get on the plane and fly and choose the lowest price. They need to be won over. They need to be treated as humans. And so I am optimistic that this translates into the future, as things, whenever that is, get back to normal, that there's a better experience overall, and people are at the forefront of many airline strategies.
Josh Solera is a global industry consultant for the advisory firm Egon Zehnder in Houston. Josh, thanks for being with us again.
Thanks for having me again, Marco.
Barbados is saying goodbye to the Queen. Yesterday, Governor General Sandra Mason announced that Barbados would remove Queen Elizabeth II as head of state in a speech prepared for her by the Prime Minister of Barbados.
The time has come to fully leave our colonial past behind. Barbadians want a Barbadian head of state.
Barbados will move to become a republic by November of next year. Christina Hines is a lecturer in political science at the University of the West Indies in Barbados. What was your reaction to the announcement, Christina? Is this a watershed moment for Barbados?
I think it is a watershed moment. I was really happy to hear the announcement. And it is a topic that has been discussed in Barbados for quite some time, since at least 1970. So to me, it is a move that is long overdue.
Right. That means there have been moves to make Barbados a republic in the past. You mentioned back in the 70s, also in 98, there was a commission that recommended republican status. Why now?
So there were some other elements within the same speech that also indicated that this current prime minister, and that's Prime Minister Mia Amor-Motley, who is the first woman to be prime minister as well in Barbados, is looking to really shift the trajectory of Barbados in some ways. So there were two other very interesting things in that throne speech, and one was the recognition of civil unions. So that would be for same-sex couples. Mm. And then there was also a proposal so that people will not be criminalized automatically for possession of small amounts of marijuana. So I think this current government is really looking to take the country in a different direction and has used this moment with all of these changes with COVID-19 and so on to reset Barbados and attempt to take it down a new trajectory.
Do you see the new head of state as also being kind of a symbolic figure like the Queen, just Barbadian?
I really believe that what we will see is that we will replace the Governor General, which is for the most part a ceremonial position, with a ceremonial president. But this person would be selected by the parliament, right? So it would be selected by the elected members that sit in our parliament in Barbados.
Finally, Christina, I want to talk about the framing of the announcement delivered by the Governor General. She said, it is time to leave our colonial past behind. So that statement coming at a time when worldwide there are protests for racial equality and for decolonization, what is the significance of those comments?
So there is a little bit of a discussion in Barbados with people who are asking, why are we making this move when it is only symbolic? And the Queen doesn't interfere in our business anyway. We are a sovereign state already. Why are we doing this? And I think it is important for symbolic reasons. It's also important for psychological reasons as well. We are a place that was formerly colonized. We have moved away from this. And I think it is time for us to take that full step of relinquishing these colonial ties. Probably most of the things about colonization were very negative and harmful to the people that live in Barbados. And at a time where or when the countries in the region are calling for reparations from the same United Kingdom, I think it's good to make this firm stand. I think it is a step that shows maturity and true independence, that we don't need to hold on to the Queen of England, even as a ceremonial figurehead.
Christina Hines is a senior lecturer in political science at the University of the West Indies in Barbados. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. When we're not here, we're online at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Support for The World comes from Odoo. What is Odoo? Well, Odoo is the only software your business will ever need. Featuring a suite of integrated business applications, Odoo connects your business operations together so you can get more done in less time. Odoo has apps for everything: CRM, accounting, sales, HR, inventory, marketing, manufacturing, you name it. Odoo's got it. To learn more, visit odoo.com/the world. That's odoo.com/the world.